And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And again, thank you to Coach's Corner, Laurie and Joel Battaglia. That was a very, very good discussion with Melanie Dunlap. And now, of course, it is Understanding Autism, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. Guys, how are you?
Doing pretty good.
Doing well.
Well and yeah. Good. Good and well.
We're recovering from a busy couple of weeks, actually.
And a busy Saturday.
Yes.
6:30 in the morning, zoo walk.
Great
event to help autism.
It was. It was awesome. Thank you. If you came out to walk or donated online, it was such a great event. And I know that we raised, as a group, overall was, I think, almost $75,000 when I checked last. But I also know that there were still, my team personally did about $2,000. But as the group, all of the teams collectively, last time I checked was about 75,000. So thank you if you were a part of making that happen. It's really appreciated.
And Paul flew out all the way for that event.
Well, that and this.
And this too, of course.
A dual purpose.
How's Houston doing?
I hear it's actually pretty cool. I guess the temperature cooled down right after I left. I heard it was in the 60s a few days ago.
Oh, nice. It's cooling down here too.
Yeah,
it's all the way to the mid-90s.
Yeah, it did go down the
Progress is progress.
That's not bad at all. So this is such a great show. Twice a month, the second Monday, second Tuesday from 3 to 4, we always have the pleasure and honor of having Paul flying all the way up from Houston, Texas. That is dedication. We really appreciate it. And, of course, Kimberly, it's always nice when you're here. It reminds me of Donnie and Marie. I mean, the perfect blend of just the right things to help so many people. I love it.
Thank you. Well, speaking of helping people, so this past weekend, as you know, we just had the Zoo Walk, and then the weekend before that, we were in San Diego, Paul and I.
Yeah.
Yes, and we spoke at an autism conference at San Diego State University, an RDI conference, and it was really exciting for us. We got a lot of good feedback. We had a lot of participants, and that's kind of how we formulated the topic for today's show.
We got a lot of feedback, and we're going to it mostly fell into some general areas, so we're going to just sort of address things that we were asked about.
Yes, and also as a side note, and Paul and I are going to be working on this, we are going to be posting our presentation online. We'll be working on that.
Yeah, hopefully we'll have it up by this weekend. We need to upload it to YouTube. Kim had the camera. I'm the one who does the uploading, so she's getting that to me tomorrow.
The Donnie and the
Marie. We're hoping to have both the video of it and a copy of the PowerPoint presentation so that people can actually look at the slides directly rather than squinting at a video to try to see what we had posted.
Yeah.
And so what was the topic that you spoke of?
We were actually, our topic, I can't remember the exact title, but it was looking beyond skill acquisition. So really understanding the difference between the what of behavior and the why was essentially the focus of it. And we did something similar in March at a autism conference here in Phoenix. We changed it up a little bit, and I think it was really helpful.
And we'll be talking more on that tomorrow when we compare the idea of knowing versus understanding when talking about doing things, which is sort of the application of the what and the why. So we'll be talking more about that tomorrow.
Yes. So should we just get right to it?
Right to it.
Well, what we did, as Paul was saying, we took the questions and the comments that we received from our feedback forms, and we kind of put them into different categories. So I guess we can just pick a category, and maybe I'll just pick. Okay. Okay. So we have sort of a diagnosis-related category of questions, and a really good question that stood out to me was in regards to why are there more diagnoses happening later in a person's life? Is it just kind of a default diagnosis, you know, a diagnosis of convenience, or is it really just manifesting later in life differently? And I thought that was a really good question. Because the answer is neither of those. And Paul and I were talking about that a little bit at lunch. And really, truly, one of the big changes that is resulting in people getting diagnosed later in life is that we understand autism better. We understand some of the subtleties better. We understand it's not just, you know, some kind of grand behavioral disorder, you know, stereotypical things. Like, I know in previous shows we talked about the concept of, like, Rain Man, and everybody sort of put, oh, that's autism, you know, Rain Man. Well, we've come a really, 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 really long ways from that. And so we understand the disorder much better, and we're able to identify it more clearly. So not just people that, I mean, the diagnosis is being given more frequently, but if you're an adult who's receiving it later in life, most likely it's not like, oh, it just manifested. It was probably always there, but people understand it better. And that's why you're seeing more diagnosis in general.
And just, there's a lot of people out there that are self-diagnosing, that are seeing some of the things from Asperger's, because there's a lot more talk about Asperger's in the technology communities that, you know, it's sort of an engineer's disorder, a thing that a certain type of mindset that, if you think you have it, it's really good to seek a proper diagnosis and to not be afraid to question and try to find someone who's an expert on it. Because if you think you have it, it is really helpful to make sure that's really what you've got, whether a confirmation or a denial, because getting the right kind of help for whatever it is that's giving you challenges is the most important thing. That don't be stuck with, well, I'm sure I have Asperger's, so this person's wrong. But also don't be afraid to question, well, they say I don't, but they aren't an expert on it. Maybe I should try to find, you know, look at autism groups and see if there's someone they recommend to, you know, who's very knowledgeable in the area. Because the key is that if it's causing a difficulty in your life, finding the right kind of help is what your goal should be.
Yeah, and it is important to find somebody who either specializes in autism spectrum disorders or comes recommended by, you know, someone, you know, somebody that that has experience in the field. Because even though, yes, we understand the disorder better sort of collectively, there are still a lot of psychiatrists out there that are misdiagnosing adults. And so it's really important that you find somebody that understands autism, that either specializes in it or, you know, like if you do contact a support group, you know, with adults, if you suspect you have it, it's a good idea to do a little homework on the professional that you choose to seek a diagnosis.
And how
from.
Would you find the professional that would really, well, you know, that you can feel comfortable with?
Well, I have two thoughts on that. I mean, one is, if you are a person who suspects maybe I have this, maybe I don't, is to do some research online. You can contact support groups, especially like the Autism Society of America. We've been talking about them a lot more lately on shows. They have resource pages. You know, in your city, there's different chapters of groups, and that would be a very good resource to contact just to get information. And really, truly, you have to be comfortable with your doctor. If you go to somebody and, you know, it's not somebody that you trust or feel comfortable with, it's okay to go to someone else. You know, not to feel stuck or bound to one person or the first person that you saw. And especially if you're a person who, you know, may be deemed as like a higher functioning person on the spectrum, because it's very hard for psychiatrists to diagnose this particular population. I'm noticing much more people coming to me that have had several diagnoses before, you know, their Asperger's. And it was just very difficult to tell because they had so many strengths and skills in other areas.
Now, so, can people write you comments and get referrals from your website or your Facebook page?
Well, hopefully with our Facebook page, you know, if someone is looking for help, maybe someone else who is also a listener to our show can say, well, I went to this person, it's really good. I don't know how big our audience is, so I don't know how all that's going to work. But we're hoping that when we've got the website set up, there'll be more opportunity for people to discuss. Unfortunately, we've kind of hit a little bit of setback, a delay there. Our web designer has had some personal life issues that have really gotten in the way. So we're actually sort of taking a step back and looking at getting it rolling again. So good. Unfortunately for our audience out there, we may be a little delayed in getting that website up after all. But
I'm happy to answer, honestly. I do have recommendations for the Phoenix area, but I also know many good professionals in other states. So I'm happy to answer. If I can refer you to somebody who may have a better idea, you can email me at rdiarizona@yahoo.com. I do know, like I said, some other RDI consultants that have ties to, you know, autism communities in different cities around the country. So I'm happy to, you know, point someone in a direction. If you're out there and feeling stuck, I'd be happy to do that.
So you're a good resource center.
Absolutely. We're doing our best.
RDI,
where I can.
RDI Arizona.
RDI Arizona@yahoo.com.
That's a good email to have. And then, of course, you have Facebook.
We have our Facebook page, and and as Paul said, we're really trying to. We had a really good start on our site, and we've got it, you know, sort of up and going. But now, and actually, if any of you out there know somebody, or you know, out there want to apply for the position, you can put that on Facebook too. We definitely need some new web support. So, anyway, side note. So, okay.
I was looking at your bracelet.
I know. Very I saw nice. That. Thank
I like
you.
That. Looks like a heart and a watch. Oh, with
it
a
is. It's
that
a Cardinals there? Bracelet watch.
Nice.
It's on a Cardinals. Yeah, it was a birthday gift. Not I
the,
love it.
Not the Houston football team.
Sorry.
Oh.
Not the Texans.
They're playing tonight, I think.
I don't watch football. Yeah. I have no idea.
Oh, that's right. It's Monday night.
4-0 against
Monday night football. Go
I
figure.
Forgot who.
I have no idea.
I'll find out before the show. Okay, back to you guys.
Yeah.
And this sort of ties into another question that we got asked at the conference, which is, when is it too late to start therapy? You know, my child is a certain age. Is it too late to really start helping him? And the answer to that is always no, it's not too late. It's never too late. No matter how old you are, there are things, knowing the condition, even for adults, knowing the condition, knowing what having that condition means, gives you the opportunity to look at where things are going wrong and say, how can I make this better? So, you know, there's this pressure, diagnose young, start treating young. And yes, that offers a lot of help, but that just offers a lot of help in the sense that it always takes time to improve. And, you know, if you start 5 years earlier, you get to the same point 5 years earlier. It's just a given, but it doesn't mean you can't progress just because you're older. You will always be able to move forward.
Yeah, that's a really important point. I mean, and this applies to so many different scenarios. If you're a parent who has an older child, a teenager or an adult who's just got diagnosed, my suspicion is you're probably just now getting into, you know, all these support groups and you're reading, okay, by the time they're three, they have to do this, this, and this. And I know that creates a lot of panic, but you need to know that exactly what Paul said, that it is never too late to get help, to participate in therapy, and for your brain to develop. I mean, our brains don't stop developing. You know, it's like, oh, I'm 35, so I guess I'm done. You know,
that's sort of a, quote, best case. The ideal is that you get an early diagnosis as early as possible. You start treatment as early as possible. Everything goes right. But the worst case, you have to remember, is not doing anything. The worst case isn't starting late. The worst case is not trying to help in the first place. So do what you can, whenever you can, as soon as you can. But don't worry if you feel like you got started late. Just keep going forward.
And that's a very important point. And on that, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion with Kimberly Isaac and Paul Alden. This is Understanding Autism. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Jessica Olson, and I'm here to introduce you to someone whose job it is to stand together with you at the worst of times. Life throws us unexpected curveballs, including losing loved ones, caretaking, troubled retirements, job losses, and legal settlements. Meet certified financial planner Larry Moscat, who pioneered crisis financial counseling. With a background as a clinical psychology practitioner, Larry has helped numerous people see through their crises to a brighter financial future. Larry?
Thank you, Jessica. At our firm, RII Advisors in North Scottsdale, we know terrible times don't usually last, but the effects of anxiety-infused financial decisions can last a lifetime. For 30 years, our prime goal has been to introduce freedom from fear and a feeling of financial security for our clients. We then move forward with safety and best-case outcome results when it comes to the financial decisions made during the worst of times.
To learn more, log on to www.RIIadvisors.com. That's RIIadvisors.com for information on how to get help. Once again, that's RIIadvisors.com for financial counseling during life's most challenging times.
Are you standing at a crossroad in life wondering what's next? Is it time to reinvent your relationship, your career, your life? Whether you're ready for a reinvention revolution or a reinvention evolution, the support of a couple of great coaches can get you there. When you decide it's time to take your life from just functional to optimal, call Joe and Lori Battaglia of Living the Dream Coaches, 888-505-5762. That's 888-505-5762, or go online to www.livingthedreamcoaches.com. That's www.livingthedreamcoaches.com.
At Beerham Baum & Spean PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum & Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston, Texas. And Houston is playing New York Jets in New York tonight. Tim Tebow. We want Tim Tebow coming on for Mark Sanchez, even though he went to USC, and I like USC. Back to you guys.
We might have to call this the ADD show.
Oh, thank you so much.
No, I know.
It's the sports show.
No, it's cute. It's cute.
I did it because Paul's from Houston.
I know.
And they're undefeated. Yay.
Okay. All right. So before we left, so we're talking about some of the questions that we had and from the conference. And just in general, these are pretty in line, though, with a lot of the questions that I get asked, you know, whether it was from the conference or just kind of in general. But just want to kind of recap, because during the break we talked about it just a little bit more, is remember that it is never too late to get help and improve. And even, you know, the question I think was originally asked in the context of someone being older. But even if you're a parent of a younger child who's 4, 5, or 6 and you're thinking, are we moving along fast enough? If, oh, shoot, we didn't reach this by age 3, and does that mean this or does that mean that? It really doesn't mean anything except that you are where you are and you continue to move forward at a pace that's appropriate for your child. You know, everybody develops at different rates, and it's not always true that more is better, as a matter of fact. You kind of have to evaluate. Quality is always the issue. And so if you start to compromise quality for quantity, that becomes a problem. So I had to,
and, you know, pushing too hard can create pushback, resistance, anxiety, that you know, it's all a wide range of things. So just keep in mind that as long as you're moving forward, you're doing okay, as long as you're actually trying to help.
Yeah. And stay calm. Stay calm. That's always a big tip. The calmest you can. I know, easier said than done, but anyways, okay, so we have some more questions here. We have another one that came up, actually in different ways, was now remember, our presentation was really focused on the what and the why of behavior. So a question that we got.
Well, let me just sort of summarize presentation real quick for the people
ahead.
Who weren't, you know.
That's true.
Is in the context of a presentation, the what is what you do and the why is why you do it. And an example of that I like to give is just basic conversational etiquette that, you know, when someone says, how are you doing? And you answer, well, I'm doing fine. Part of that is the what you're saying. And, you know, you take it very literally, but often people on the spectrum take it very literally, rather. But the why you're doing it is sort of to create comfort, that it's not necessarily about answering the questions, but about creating, you know, a social connection before you start the real conversation, that a lot of the things that we do, there's a reason for them, and then there's the actual action. And the reason may not be nearly as obvious to someone on the spectrum, because a lot of that reason is sort of tied into our social instincts that someone on the spectrum may not have. And this doesn't necessarily apply just to social situations, but in all things, we had someone who had a bad back, and he'd often ask his son to help him with things. And he assumed that his son understood when he was asking for help it was because of his bad back. But his son may not have caught that, because that connection there, that mental connection of he's asking me for help because his back is bothering him, is just not the sort of connection that someone on the spectrum might instinctually make. So there's a great value in, when you ask someone or talk to someone about something, making sure that the why is apparent, explaining it rather than just assuming that they'll pick up what the why is. So that was sort of the topic of our discussion. We discussed it quite a bit more and gave a lot more examples, but it's really about what and then following through with why, because you can't assume that they're going to understand that.
Right, and especially with, I mean, it definitely goes across the spectrum, it looks like different things. But when you have a person who has a lot of skills, you know, has a lot of language and things like that, you would automatically assume, well, if they're able to do this, how can they not know the why? I mean, that was kind of a big issue that we touched on in our presentation as well, because, you know, and in that particular conference, you know, there was a lot of discussion about brain connectivity and autism and why that would be, why that would happen is that certain parts of the brain are not talking to each other in the way that they should. And that results in many things, one of which being, you know, the whys aren't so obvious, you know, to people on the spectrum, regardless of their skills or, you know, intelligence. So a question that we got frequently was, how would we teach the why to a person who is lower functioning or didn't have the skills? Or would it even be appropriate to teach the why to a person who had less skills? And my answer is absolutely yes. First of all, you never want to assume either way. You know, you don't want to assume, oh, someone has all these skills, so they must know this. Or, wow, someone doesn't have hardly any skills, so they must not know anything. You know, you don't want to make assumptions on either end. And I work with many people who are on, well, kind of all across the spectrum. But when I think of the lower functioning population, remember that there's a lot of disconnects in the brain for a person who has autism. And if they're lower functioning, that is a result of not just autism, because really the mental processes involved that are core deficits of autism are kind of one issue. And then people who have trouble with actual skills or speaking is actually a different issue. And so not to confuse the two. So a person may not visibly have many skills or abilities to do things for themselves or even to speak, but that doesn't mean that other things in their brain aren't strong. It may be harder to see that because they're not able to produce, you know, the same way you would think. I think it's a good habit to clarify your communication in any situation. I mean, it can't hurt. And it just goes, it helps put you and the person that you're interacting with sort of on a common ground. It's kind of like, okay, you know, whether you know this or not, it doesn't hurt for me to share, you know, this is why I think this is important, you know, or this is why we're doing this. Doesn't take very long. It's a really good way of sort of slowing down the situation, getting even, you know, keeled on it. And so regardless of skills or functioning level, it is a good idea to talk about the why and share your thoughts about things. It's my two cents.
And I mean, I just agree completely that, you know, it's really important that we instinctually assume that someone is going to interpret things the same way we do. I've talked about this a few times on the show. And part of that is learning things the way we do. That, you know, that if someone always told me, well, you need to mow the lawn or whatever, I learned from that that it's important to maintain the lawn. Someone may not get that. So, and the thing is that they may not pick up the why at all, where they may just take it very factual as, okay, he said to mow the lawn, so I'm mowing the lawn, and not think any further about it, not think, well, I mowed the lawn this time last week, I mowed the lawn this time the week before, I probably need to mow the lawn, you know, weekly. They may not pick that up. But the thing is they may not pick up anything, or they may make the wrong connections. When they start, you know, seeing that they aren't getting along in the world, you know, when they start noticing things wrong and they start asking what's going wrong here, they may try to figure out the why themselves. And if they don't have any guidance in that area, they could come up with completely different whys that don't really fit in and sort of deviate even further from the social norm as they've come up with a framework for themselves that creates frustration because they don't understand what's going on and the explanations they've found don't work. So that's sort of where the real, like, depression and anxiety start coming in, is when they start trying to explain things and find out that they can't come up with explanations. So it's not just a case of, I don't know what to do, but now that I think I do know what to do, the reasons I've found for it are all wrong. So having someone to help guide with the why can really help with a sort of the anxiety, the depression, the other sort of issues with it. And that was, again, another one of the questions we got was someone mentioned that their son was having a lot of depression in high school and not getting along well. One thing to remember, they said they were afraid of looking at the medication option. One thing to remember is that depression is a real medical condition, that there are people who are depressed because of brain chemistry, and then there are people who are depressed just because of the circumstances they're in. Sometimes medication can help lift you out as a temporary measure. Sometimes medication is an ongoing thing, and that's not a bad thing. That if it's a brain chemistry thing, it's something that needs to be fixed. If, you know, if someone was missing their left hand, we wouldn't for a second say, well, I'm afraid of using a prosthetic. You know, that, you know, it's it gets you the ability to, you know, do things that you couldn't do before. You know, and it's the same thing with medication. If someone genuinely needs it, there's a benefit to seeking a diagnosis and seeking a prescription that works. And so it's not something to be afraid of. It's also not something to dive into. It's something to talk with an expert about and, you know, do your research on. But it really is important to remember that autism can lead to depression, but autism can also just occur alongside a depression that isn't related to it. So, right. You know, so these, you know, solving why, helping your kid, don't be upset if the depression doesn't clear up as things start getting better in other areas, because maybe it's something else that needs to be addressed. But this is something that can help with a lot of the depression and anxiety that go alongside autism, is helping them to understand what's going on around them.
Well, and the key is, and that in this question that Paul's referring to is, a parent who said, you know, I have a teenager, young adult who is very lonely and depressed, and but this parent's afraid to pursue the medication route. It's very valid fears for different reasons. I know it can be scary because you don't know how the medication's going to affect the person. Is it going to make him angry? Is it going to? I mean, that's just for anybody. I mean, even for any of us who are.
And I will say, I've had experience with that. I suffered from depression. I took one medication. It made me very quick to anger, and
really?
I didn't like it, and I went off of it. Recently, I've been on medication again for depression. I thought I was mostly over it, but I found myself having sort of depressive episodes, and it's been helping a lot. Really, finding the right medication is very important. They all have different side effects and different effects, but if you do find the right one, if there really is a need for it, it can create an immense benefit in your life. So it's really something not to be afraid of. I mean, approach it carefully, consult experts, but don't be afraid of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a possibility that, like as Paul was saying, a person would genuinely need it. But I would say, you know, from experience that, I mean, not only do people just react differently to medication, I have noticed that people on the spectrum sometimes have even kind of more deviated reactions to medicine. It's not good or bad. It's just information. And so people who do decide to go the medication route, you know, a lot of times, and I'm sure that their psychiatrists or doctors who are prescribing are telling them, but I kind of always remind them, too, that one of the tricky things about medication, it really is trial and error, and there's a level of patience that has to happen, and it's hard because you can't just be on something for a week and, you know, it worked or it didn't. I mean, sometimes you have to give things time, and of course you always go by what the person prescribing you, you know, tells you to do, but I think the point is to engage in these things very deliberately, very mindfully, and also not to surrender everything to medication. It's not like, okay, well, here's the medication. There's nothing else to be done. There are other things, too. It's just important to sort of look at the situation in its entirety and separate, you know, out different things.
And that's true, again, is that the goal of medication is to restore normal function in that part of the brain. So if there are external pressures that would make a normal person depressed, you might find the medication doesn't get you past everything. It just gives you a starting point, you know, so that you're starting from the same place as everyone else rather than starting from an already depressed area and then having all this on top of it. So don't be discouraged just because it doesn't seem to be helping as much as you thought it would, because there may still be things that you need to address in other areas.
Yeah, and addressing some of those co-occurring things, and again, Paul was saying, I mean, it's hard to tell. People on the spectrum tend to have co-occurring conditions. So if you're a listener, you may be very familiar with this, where, you know, you're the person in mind that has autism, or if it's you, you know, may have some attentional difficulties, maybe a little bit of struggle with anxiety and or depression. It's really not uncommon for it to come sort of all in a package. But what's really hard to tell sometimes, and that's where the deliberate thought comes in and kind of dissection of it all, is the depression there as a co-occurring condition, genuinely the brain chemistry side of it, or is it a result of having autism and having these experiences that are overwhelming and confusing and perceived as failing? And, you know, it's like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg type thing. But it's important to just think it through and
not rule anything out.
And not rule anything out, you know. But anyway, so in retrospect to that question is, so you have a teen adult child that is feeling depressed and lonely. You know, I would definitely start out by taking him for a proper evaluation for depression And based on those results, I would start sort of weeding out, you know, what you need to weed out as a result of what you found. And, you know, also counseling is also a very good thing. Nutritional related things are very good. It's just important to stay as, I guess you want to strive for clarity. Every time you find something out, it's information on what to do next. And so I know that's, it's a troubling question. I've had that question a lot. You know, it's
but the key is what, to remain open to possibilities.
Yes.
That goes a long way.
Yeah.
For more awareness, why don't we take another quick break? And when we come back, we will continue our discussion with Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. This is Understanding Autism. We'll be right back.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
Hirschberger Assisted Living Home for the Elderly, whether it's a need to recuperate after surgery or just need daily assistance to enrich their life, you can trust that your loved one is being well cared for. Our caregivers are fully licensed by the Arizona Department of Health. An experienced team of professionals provide expert medical care, including physical, occupational, and recreational therapy, wound care, medication management, nutritional support, and personal care. All faiths are welcome. Hirschberger Assisted Living Home, founded in 1997, will provide your loved ones a quality of life with loving care. Call Shirley Hirschberger today at 602-314-6937. That's 602-314-6937, or visit the website ahomewithshirley.com. Hirschberger Assisted Living, home is where the heart is.
Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm on the spectrum.
And I'm Kim, and I'm an autism specialist.
The second Monday and Tuesday of each month at 3 p.m. on 1010 a.m.
And online at breakradioshow.com, live and archived.
We're here to help you with
Understanding Autism.
Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues in corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Ridenour, Hynten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Kimberly Isaac and Paul Loudon. Now, I had a question that I thought of on the break, and the spectrum is very large.
It
is quite.
It really is.
It's just from, it's like from A to Z and beyond. It's like,
right.
It's so diverse in terms of trying to understand how person A can have autism, person B has autism, but they seem so different. I mean, like, day and night. And I would like an answer to that, because I really think people are curious about that. So, who wants to give that a shot?
Okay, first I'm going to start with, I don't know all the science behind autism, obviously. There's new research happening every day. But some of the things I've come to understand is that often it relates to how functional certain areas of the brain are and how well they're connected. There's a lot of research showing that level of mitochondrial function has a very close correlation to the seriousness of autism symptoms. And mitochondria are what provide energy to your cells through different processes. So it's sort of how good your body is at producing active energy. So one way to sort of think about this spectrum is think about a bunch of people who are in varying degrees of being in shape, from a professional baseball pitcher to a guy who never leaves his couch except when he has to go to work, who's sort of flabby. They can all probably throw a baseball, but they can probably throw it at very different speeds and very different distances. And there may be other people who are disabled in various ways who can't even pick up a baseball, who understand the idea of throwing a baseball but simply can't do it because their body doesn't let them. Now, if you replace throwing a baseball with certain types of social and mental processes, the processes that people on the spectrum are weak in, you see that there can be varying degrees of weakness in that, and they can have more or less obvious symptoms. I mean, throwing a baseball less distance is not really a disability, but being unable to throw that baseball is. So when you get below a certain point, those challenges start to affect their ability to live everyday lives, that they become harder to make friends, harder to understand what people mean, and eventually they get to the point where it becomes harder to learn basic skills and understand, you know, what you're supposed to do and why, just to take care of yourself, because it becomes harder to understand, you know, why it's important to take care of yourself. So it's not really, I don't want to call it a learning disability, because it's not about learning so much as the ability to process. But as you grow weaker in it, it becomes autism. It becomes the autism spectrum once it becomes a challenge to live day-to-day life, where it has a negative impact on your ability to live life. And that's sort of one of the diagnostic criteria is, does it interfere with their ability to live a normal life? So one could argue that it's sort of part of a natural spectrum, but it's a point where that natural spectrum becomes so bad, or not so bad, but so different that it interferes with the ability to lead normal life. It's a certain number of deviations out, and it does relate to, you know, there are physical issues that cause this, and there are different ones. That's one thing that's sort of been seen with when we talk with Dr. Adams, is that, you know, autism can come sort of from different things, where, you know, heavy metal toxicity because your body can't process the metals well, or low lithium, or all the various things that autism correlates with a bunch of different physical conditions, because possibly many of these different physical conditions cause the same set of symptoms that is autism. So certain things impede your brain's performance, and when your brain's performance in certain areas becomes low enough, that's autism.
I've never heard you describe it that way. I have something to add to that, but yeah, I've never heard you describe it that way. That's insightful, as always.
Does it sound about right?
Yes. I mean, I don't want to say right or wrong, because this is like a spectrum is a spectrum.
Yeah,
it's a heavy duty situation. We can't just leave it at one thing or another.
Well, did I say anything you would specifically disagree with?
No.
Okay.
No.
Just making sure that throw
as a layperson, should I
would
summarize
you.
That?
Sure. Go ahead.
Because I think it's very interesting, and you answered my question, because it's at what point. What I got out of this is that there's a certain point that you measure where, if it's a challenge in everyday life, then you might be at the top of that challenge, so it doesn't always appear it's a challenge.
It's less obvious.
Yeah, it's less, but to very obvious challenges. Mm-hmm. So that was very good. I like that. I guess the question I would say is, who decides that point?
Well, that's the diagnostician, the person you go to, and they ask you about your past, they ask you about your present, they talk to maybe your parents or teachers and say, how was he 10 years ago? Did he have difficulty in school? You know, you talk to someone, they ask you a lot of questions, they maybe give you an IQ test or give you a form to fill out that, you know, shows how you related to certain social situations. They may point at pictures of people and say, what do you think this person is thinking right now? There's, you know, a wide variety of types of questions they might ask you to try to figure out sort of whether you have challenges in these areas and how bad it is. And honestly, for most mental problems, the biggest condition is, does it affect your ability to live an everyday life? Mm. That's sort of the key diagnostic point in most things is, does it affect your ability to live an everyday life? And if the answer to that is yes, then the rest of diagnosing is figuring out, well, which of these things is it? Why does it affect your ability to live everyday life? But the big question is, you know, does it get in your way?
And but one last thing then is, there's probably many things that can get in your way that's not autism, am I right?
And that's what makes diagnosing it so hard is that,
interesting,
you know,
right?
Is that, you know, you might have symptoms of depression, or you might have symptoms of, you know, other things that sort of overshadow what's the underlying cause. And you might, especially if you're someone on the spectrum trying to seek a diagnosis on your own without the help of people around you, you may not really be able to recognize where you had problems. So you may not be able to sort of give them that push in the right direction necessarily.
Yeah, and I just want to add, because my first thought when you asked me that, I get asked this a lot too, but the big difference is, I mean, the way I've learned it and understand it is, the spectrum, they call it the spectrum because you'll see observably a wide variety of behaviors. I mean, that's what you see. But there are commonalities between everybody on the spectrum. I mean, there has to be. That's how you would diagnose.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And the commonalities are specifically related to mental processes. Because a person, despite their skills or IQ, can still have, there's a particular part of the brain related to the prefrontal cortex that's not connecting with the rest of the brain as it should. It's kind of the prefrontal cortex is like the flexibility boss, the executive decision maker. This is what the commonality is for people with autism, again, regardless of their other abilities, is the parts of their brain that are integrating, are supposed to be integrating for flexibility, you know, perspective taking, you know, things like that, is not connecting the right way. And so you can line up everybody on the spectrum from, as you said, A to Z, and observably on the surface, you'll see a bunch of different things. But in the brain, the same core things are happening or not happening, which leads to, and Paul's definition really helps, I think, put this in perspective, but because based on someone's other skills or abilities, it will look different to an extent, but ultimately, it's all about the mental processes. And they do have, right now, there are specific diagnostic tools that people use. The ADOS is a really specific one. It's kind of the most, it's the Autism Diagnostic Observation Scale. It's a specific test they'll give you. Although with the changes in the DSM, I'm going to be curious to see how they're going to, you know, do all of that. But really, truly, the spectrum is observably, yes, it would be hard to believe you can put person A and person B and they both have autism. It's like, how can that be? It has nothing to do with what you see on the outside, to be honest. I mean, really, either way, because a person can have really poor motor skills and not talking. That's not autism. That's something that might go along with the autism. So it's, you can't really judge it by what you see. You know, you have to really kind of dissect some of the behavior that you're seeing and really put it in the right, sort of the right file, I guess you could say. And then there's a common file right in the middle. That's the mental processes and the connectivity and the processing. And that's the file that makes, that's the commonality.
So file. That's what makes this show so important, because it's a resource for people to understand further. And it would seem like to me that it's really important to be associated with the right people to make the right diagnosis, because that would then lead to the treatment.
Yes. Yes. Oh, it looks like we got a text question.
Yeah, I think it came in a little while ago while we were discussing medication.
Okay.
Our question is, are individuals on the spectrum more likely to have success using medication than not, statistically speaking?
Oh.
Unfortunately, I don't have any research on this.
I have an answer.
Yeah, you wanna? Go for
okay.
it.
Okay, all right. Well, a couple of things. This is a really good question. The thing is, there's no medication that's prescribed specifically for the autism itself.
Well, I think this was relating to, like, depression and anxiety.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to get to that. I'll get to
okay.
that. Yeah, I'm just clarifying, those of you, for everybody. We'll just lay it all out. But it really depends on what the co-occurring factors are. So if you have autism and you also have severe depression, it would make sense to treat the depression as what it is, and that would minimize that obstacle. Because anything that's co-occurring to the autism is making your development, your growth, and your healing related to the autism much harder. So you want to minimize things that are getting in the way, basically, of you learning. And so, you know, you identify what those things are. So, you know, sometimes, I don't know that there's an actual, like, definite, you know, with anybody, because I think of medication for just the general population. Some people respond really well to it. Some people don't. I think there's a lot of factors. I mean, in my personal experience, the truth is I've kind of seen it go a 50-50. Sometimes medication is like, wow, that helped that particular issue, which in turn helped the person to grow and develop, you know, in the way that they wanted to. And other times it's been very, very hard to find medication, because some of the people that have other co-occurring things such as epilepsy or other more medical related issues, their brains don't respond the same way to medication. So it's very individualized. And I think that that's actually a really important message to actually state more and more on the show is yes, there's a spectrum and yes, there are commonalities, but every person is an individual person, just like with any disorder, you know, whether it was cancer or what, you know, everybody, there might be some common things that you would do to go about helping that person, but people are very complex.
And they respond
really
differently.
They respond differently, and you really have to look at the person in their entirety and not just...
Yeah, and just don't lump everything in with the autism.
Yeah, because like, not everything's autism, believe me, and that's a huge problem. I mean, it's like, oh, you know, this person's, you know, having trouble with motor skills. That's autism. You know, it's part of the autism. It's actually not part of the autism. Yeah. It's another difficulty or challenge that the person's brain is having, but that's not the autism. Autism is very... processing specific in terms of brain connectivity, and I guess you could say we talked about there's core deficits in particular, and actually we should probably do a core deficit show now
and,
that I'm
and honestly the motor skills, I mean, it may be that they're having difficulty learning the motor skills because the autism is impeding their ability
Absolutely.
To relate with the person teaching them.
That could
but,
be.
You know, the autism could relate to it, but there's the difference between the symptom and the core condition.
Right.
And the motor skills may be a symptom. They may be something else. They may not be related at all. We see motor skills difficulties a lot alongside autism, but that can be for a variety of different reasons. And so it's important to be aware that you need to probably reassess frequently, you know, okay, is this helping the motor skills or can I look at them from a different angle? Is this helping the depression or can I look at it from a different angle? I mean... again, they ask statistically, is medication more or less likely to help people on the spectrum with these kind of depression and anxiety things? And we don't have that specific data. But honestly, I would say that even if it was statistically less likely to help, I would still look at it as an option just because for the people it will help, it will help. And for the people that it won't help, it probably won't cause any real harm, that it's something – depression medication is fairly safe. It has some side effects, but as long as you're careful and aware of the side effects, you can watch for them, you can talk with your doctor about them. They risk side effects in everyone. So it's something that you should consider, you should talk with your doctor about, and you should consider on an individual basis that we can't really give you good advice on that other than definitely talk with your doctor about it and keep your mind open as a possibility.
Yeah, and I think the key is really here with both questions, the spectrum question and the medication question, is you... when you're involved in autism, it's kind of you become a lifelong learner, whether you're the parent, the professional, the person on the spectrum. I mean, that's basically what's going to happen. And it's a good thing, actually, because, you know, for one, this people are complex. Autism is complex. You know, life is ever changing. Everything's very dynamic. It's really important that you stay open to learning about what's what. In the individual that you're helping, you know, okay, what is the autism and what is this, you know, what is depression or what is the ADD? I mean, because they all kind of mesh together. They really do. And it's very difficult to kind of separate what, you know, out what's what, but you have to continue to learn and update your assessment. You know, you don't want to go more than, I mean, usually I would say most people do like an annual type assessment. I mean, that's fine. I'm more on the side of like 6 months, you know, and just as well as ongoing. I mean, you should, if you notice something's changing, you want to take note of it and not wait till, okay, we said 6 months, we're going to wait till 6 months. You know, you want to kind of do an ongoing, you know, assessment with the person that you're helping. But it's important just to stay open and continue to learn. And also, you know, to trust yourself. I think if you're, especially if you're a parent, you know, a lot of time your gut feelings are right. And sometimes it's scary because you forget that when you hear autism and you're like, I don't know what to do. I have to rely on everybody else to tell me. And while you will need guidance, it's very important not to lose your parental gut. You know, you want to go with that and follow along with that, even if it's in deciding who are the professionals I feel comfortable working with, you know.
And as parents, there's only 4 minutes left in the show. This flew by. Would you both recommend that parents really take this seriously and become really aware that sometimes behavioral issues are not what it appears to be?
Sometimes. Ugh.
That would bother me.
Sometimes.
Let's say a parent would
a lot.
You know, get mad at someone, their little kid, and it's just a core deficit or something that they can't help. That's a tragedy. Parents
honestly
need to be aware.
My advice to everyone, people relating to the spectrum, people not relating to the spectrum, people everywhere in every situation.
Just people.
Anytime something goes wrong, start off with the assumption it was a misunderstanding.
I love that. That's what I do.
That's very good.
I mean, in general, and especially in the work, is the thing is when you assume, you're not really in a position to attend to what needs attending in a clear way. I mean, like I said, everything's way too dynamic for reactions to be the right answers to anything. Of course, it's easier said than done, and I'm not saying, I know parents, naturally, they would feel frustrated and confused and scared, and that's all okay. But it's important to take that and use it productively. You know, to say, okay, I am scared, I am worried or nervous or whatever, and I know the best thing I can do right now is to learn more, because if I keep reacting, it's definitely not a good thing to be reactionary.
Because then the little kid, unfortunately,
or teenager, or adult, or whoever,
or anyone, could be, well, I wanted to say like a punching bag, and that's a brutal way of saying it, but if you think about it, they're going to be... it's just not fair.
Well, the other thing is when you punish a kid for doing something wrong and they don't understand what they did wrong, they don't learn the lesson that you wanted them to learn. So even if your objective is to teach them don't do that again, if they aren't aware what you're trying to teach them, you failed and it's not going to work. So even if you are absolutely certain that you want to punish them, you need to make sure that they understand what they're being punished for first, which means you need to understand why they did what they did.
Oh, that's a good way of summing it up. But yeah, I mean, I know, and actually parents, that's another show, we're taking notes here, having a parent show, because it's very emotional, and no parent, you know, obviously intentionally wants to do harm, but sometimes this is so frustrating and overwhelming for a parent, they just really can't even get themselves to a right place to take action from, and honestly, if that's you, your first step is you.
Well, I was going to say that.
Not your child. So it's like, okay, if you're at that point, your next action in terms of therapy is for yourself, and that's a good thing. It's not something to feel weak about or shamed about. Is if you're not in a position to be the guide and the leader, that's information that tells you, okay, my next step in helping my child is helping myself so I can help my child.
And because all the stresses of the world, sometimes that can interfere with your judgment.
Totally.
It's your stress. Take care of it. Wow, that should be another show. I want that to be a show. Kimberly Isaac, Paul Alden, thank you.
So tomorrow we'll be talking about the difference between knowing and understanding. Anyone who has more questions or feels like their question didn't get fully answered, feel free to contact us at facebook.com/understandingautismradio. We'll try to answer there or maybe mention it on a future show.
Well, thank you so much. We'll
thank
see
you
everyone
so much.
Tomorrow. And Tuesday,
Yeah.
Understanding versus knowing. Have a great night.